we go.
All right. Okay, we'll go ahead and pick up where we left off. Then we had been discussing this rising up in chapter 17 of Jehoshaphat. And now in chapter 18, we see how he goes down. And I thought it was interesting when we talk about this. In verse 2, he had gone down to Ahab, to Samaria. And look at the way the scriptures lay this out to us. Had gone down to Ahab, down to Samaria. And we see how Ahab and Samaria were actually north of Jerusalem, right? So isn't it interesting how we see this spiritual decline that's taking place? And we talked about Jehoshaphat giving his son Jehoram in marriage to Athaliah. So in these two names then, we have this clear setting forth of the two policies and the results then, don't we, of these two policies. The rising up and then Yah hath constrained. So it's unwise to look, as we know, to look outside of God's boundaries for a mate. Scriptural counsel for us makes it clear that this leads to destruction. So when we look at these verses for an example, because even when intentions are good, too often it leads to an Athaliah and a Jehoram type situation where the truth is compromised and often completely lost. And isn't it interesting that if you look at the history of the truth in the Scriptures, almost every single period of falling away is preceded by a casual attitude toward relationships outside of God's boundaries. A casual attitude. And so let's consider some of the aspects then of this wedding that we see took place. In any wedding, we know, we're all familiar with, there's a mountain of decisions to be made, isn't there? Planning to do, all sorts of things to consider. And not to mention what it all means, this joining together of the two, being joined together as one. And can you imagine, it's shocking really, to think about how this event would have taken place knowing the difference in these two families, in the family of Ahab and Jezebel and that of Jehoshaphat. Ahab and Jezebel being haters of the things of Yahweh. And how do we know that? Because in verse 2 of chapter 19, shouldest thou love the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? That's what they were described as. So we have them on the one side and the people of God, Jehoshaphat's family, on the other. We also have in consideration the Hebrew people and the Sidonians. The Sidonians were where Jezebel was from. And so we have on every single detail that ever would come up in this alliance, we have two opposite ways of thinking, two opposite references or relationships to the truth. And they would have been miles apart. But Jehoshaphat went through with it anyway. Jehoshaphat made his concessions. He swallowed his better judgment, and he was determined to align himself with his people and his people with Ahab. All Israel, once again, joined together, and perhaps he still believed that he could save them. Did he feel this was right? They were once together, all joined together in unity. Boy, look at what a wonderful aspect this would have been. But was it really? Again, look at 2 Chronicles 18:2 and see how Jehoshaphat is described now. As we saw, after certain years, and it's thought to be about 10 years, he goes down. And it didn't take long, didn't it? The digression as he goes down, like stepping down steps in the opposite direction. And this is exactly what he was doing. He was leaving Jerusalem. Now think of the significance, brothers and sisters, in that. Leaving Jerusalem, the king of Judah leaving Jerusalem, joining in affinity with Ahab in Samaria. We'll talk about Samaria in just a minute. So in other words, while he was a man of good intentions, we said, and a man of good motives, He compromises God's principles in pursuit of a friendship and harmony and unity with Israel. He was rich in the things of the truth. His people were greatly blessed. Why did he feel like he had to do this? Well, we know from 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 and 15, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? Or what part hath he that believeth with an infidel?" And look at this here. "And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols?" Does that not describe Jezebel and the Sidonians? He says, "For ye are the temple of the living God." In this we are taught that no harmony and no unity, and there is no sweet song, we might say, when these two are mixed together. Think of harmony for a moment. From a musical aspect, we think of harmony as when tones, musical notes, are mixed together to form a beautiful sound, isn't it? A symphony, if you will, in rich unison. This rich unison that's brought together of the musical notes, then, shows to us this idea of being of one mind, forming together, singing with one voice, making hymns and spiritual songs, as we read in Ephesians 5. Singing and making melody in your heart to God, or to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things. So we see this unity of mind and this idea of this rich harmony and symphony that's brought out. Well, think of this. Was this ever possible with Jehoshaphat and Ahab? Unless there was a total compromise by one side or the other. There was no middle ground. It was one way or the other. And obviously, Jehoshaphat was the compromising factor. So back to 2 Chronicles chapter 18 at verse 2 again. We went through that, but we see how... Let's think of this now. Ahab had killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance. And so not only did Jehoshaphat go down to Samaria, as we read, but also he took a whole host of people with him. And instead of Ahab making offerings to Yahweh, especially since he didn't worship Yahweh, right? He made offerings to Jehoshaphat. He killed sheep and oxen for him, for Jehoshaphat. So what does this mean to us? Well, it's that it shows us that they saw him coming, and they knew that they had to completely sway him, and they knew that they would have to keep him in order to gain any benefit from it. And so they sacrificed for him. They began to build him up and to make him feel as though he was a strong support in this new alliance. And they poured it on thick, and so Jehoshaphat was convinced. And as the record says in verse 2, Ahab had persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead. And so, in the account then, in 1 Kings, we have the account of the killing of Naboth and his sons by this evil, conniving plan of Jezebel. We don't really have a whole lot of time to go into that, but we're familiar with how Ahab wanted this land that belonged to Naboth. And so the only way to get it was for him to be killed. And so Jezebel had connived this plan of having him killed. And so the account is summed up, though, in verse 25. And it explains how Ahab was moved to do such a horrific thing and to an innocent man and his entire family. So in verse 25, "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife had stirred up." I'm sorry, that's from 1 Kings 21:25. And so the point that I'm trying to make here is we see this wickedness that had taken place here just on this one account. But how did it happen? It's mentioned plainly there for us, "whom Jezebel his wife stirred up." He stirred up Ahab in order to make him do this. So stirred up, then, this phrase comes from a word Hebrew word, suth, S-U-T-H, meaning to prick or to stimulate. And it first occurred back in Deuteronomy 13, verses 6 through 10, from the root word for briars and thorns. And that is mentioned here. It says, if thy brother or thy wife of thy bosom or thy friend entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods which thou hast not known, nor thy fathers. He says, thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones, that he die, because he hath sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God. So this was the message in Deuteronomy to those who would lead others astray from God and from his ways. So this was that stirred up there to entice or to prick or stimulate. And also in Judges 2, verse 3, speaking of the Canaanites in the land and how they could prick as a thorn into Israel if they ever made an alliance with them. And of course, Jezebel was of the Canaanites of the land, wasn't she? And here in Kings, we see that the man Ahab described as one who is being pricked as by a thorn, stirred up by this evil wife Jezebel to do these evil things. And so the word persuaded here in 2 Chronicles 18, verse 2, is the same thing. Ahab had persuaded him to go up to him, to Ramoth-Gilead. So we see, it's interesting, we see that the same policy which Ahab was operating under Jezebel, he was now implementing with Jehoshaphat. He was pricking and prodding and pleading with him and convincing him to go and do something that he knew was wrong. What Jezebel did to him, he proceeded to do to Jehoshaphat. And so in that, he had given his firstborn son up to Athaliah. In a way, this was a death sentence for a young man with Jezebel as a mother-in-law. Ahab had just showered him with accolades of sacrifices, and it blinded him and made him think that he indeed was strong and that he could be important and make a difference in Israel. But Ahab just wanted his army. Ahab wanted to save his own skin from the Syrian, Ben-Hadad, who was coming for blood to get Ahab. But we see here that he had identified himself with Ahab, and it brought Jehoshaphat to a bitter and sorrowful low. So from this we learn, we must be careful of the company that we keep. So with that in mind, I have a quote I'd like to read for us. And this is from the year 1987. And for some of us, it doesn't seem like that long ago. From 1987, we have a brother that wrote, "The offer of union is dangled before ecclesias today like a carrot before donkeys, but not always on sound principles. We have sought to help the cause of unity where the issues are sound, but are opposed to mere union based on a policy of emotion, compromise of basic doctrines of truth, or refusal to implement the terms of fellowship. It's useless pressing the value in the absence of what truly establishes it. Indeed, there comes a time when it is best to stand aside and for the benefit of all concerned, wait patiently for truth to prevail. There are many in different parts of the ecclesial world pressing for union without proper regard for the requirements of unity, the elevation of Yahweh's ways in doctrine and in fellowship. In the absence of such, the warning example of Scripture is recorded in the failure of Jehoshaphat's policy of compromise, and it should be given careful consideration." Again, a quote from 1987. He continues by saying, "To hasten the cause of mere affinity without the unifying influence of a mutual acceptance and application of the truth can set in train a course of action that can lead to a disastrous result." He continues, "We cannot risk that on the eve of Christ's return. We must strengthen the things that remain, and until a sound basis for true unity is mutually accepted, await the coming of our Lord, who will establish it on principles that will be honoring to Yahweh in doctrine and in practice. Again, a quote from 1987, and I thought how fitting that seems to be for our day and time as well. He uses the example of Jehoshaphat and his compromise. We see that his quote here speaks of sound principles in contrast to a policy of emotion. To faithfully implement the terms of fellowship, knowing the standards of our Master are high, and strengthening those things of doctrine that bind us together, he says, in the hope of his calling. Knowing that the time is drawing nigh, he says, quote, we cannot risk that on the eve of Christ's return. We cannot compromise then, can we? And then wait in regret of our fateful decision. We must do what is right. Be valiant for the truth and teach it without compromise, as Brother Thomas said. And all lovers of the truth will approve. And so, brethren, we truly must be careful of the company that we keep. And so next then in our account here in chapter 18, we see how Ahab slaughters the sheep and oxen himself. He may have considered himself sort of a high priest of his system then, didn't he? But keep in mind that it then says he persuaded him to go up with him to Ramoth-Gilead, which was a city of refuge. Remember, under the law of Moses, there were certain cities that were designated in case of an accidental killing. So there was a city of refuge, Ramoth-Gilead. And of course, Ahab would not have recognized it as such. But it was. And so remember in 1 Kings 21, where we had this account of Ahab murdering Naboth. He was sort of a pseudo-high priest, we might say, here in 2 Chronicles. And he was also a murderer, wasn't he? And say they are going to the city of refuge. And so we'll come back to that in just a minute. But chapter 18, verse 3, we have Ahab saying, wilt thou go with me to Ramoth-Gilead? And so to make sure that Jehoshaphat would agree, he asks him plainly, will you go? And then Jehoshaphat replies, if we can believe it, he says, I am as thou art, and my people as thy people. He completely identifies himself and his people with Ahab. He in effect says, brother, you represent me and my people as thy people. Does this bring to mind the words of the prophet Amos? Can two walk together except they be agreed? Well, these two are now in agreement, so to speak, in fellowship, if you will. And look at these words again. I am as thou art, and my people as thy people. We will be with thee. Where else do we remember a phrase like this, similar to this, in the account? Well, this might remind us of Ruth. Ruth, in chapter 1, Ruth 1, verse 16, says a very similar phrase. And remember, in this brief account, we have Elimelech had taken his wife and his sons, Mahlon and Chilion, down into the land of Moab. And we see that of these, three out of four of them had died of their small ecclesia, we might say. And they had left the boundaries of the promised land, and think of that, due to the doubt and faithlessness that they had, and they entered into Moab. Remember, there was a drought in the land. There was a drought. But they felt, Elimelech thought he had to leave. He had to leave the boundaries of the land and go where he thought maybe the grass was a little greener. But that being aside, we know from the account of Ruth that it was all for a purpose, right? And so, then Ruth comes up with Naomi and she dedicates herself to the God of Israel. And this is what Ruth says to Naomi. As she goes through her own spiritual convincing and baptism, we might say, and committing her life to Yahweh, God of Israel. And this was the purpose of gaining Ruth, we see, as this took place. And so Jehoshaphat, he takes Ruth's pledge, we might say, and instead he turns it around and pledges his allegiance to evil Ahab. Ruth said, whether thou goest, I will go, and whether thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. And so it's such a shame that Jehoshaphat would apply the beautiful words of Ruth to a oath, to a very wicked king like Ahab. And as we continue, we see Jehoshaphat asks a very telling question of Ahab. In verse 4, he says, of chapter 18, "And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, Inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today." Inquire, I pray thee. Of course, this comes from a word that means to seek. Seek the word of Yahweh today. And so it's obvious here that Jehoshaphat had gotten things out of order, didn't he? He had already made this affinity. He had already initiated this of his own accord and formed this alliance with Ahab. And then he agrees to go to war with him. And then he says here, oh, by the way, should we seek the word of the Lord? The problem is, he had already done his convincing already. He had already done his committing. And this is definitely not the order that we go about things in our service to our Father. We must always first seek the Lord for help and wisdom in whatever we're doing, right? Even if we think it's a small and insignificant decision. Proverbs 3:5-7 says, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil." How often do we feel like we know what's best? We're in control. Was Jehoshaphat in control? Sure he was. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. Also Romans 12:12 says, "Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing instant in prayer." Instant, brothers and sisters, at the time of decision. Let's continue then in verse 5. We see, "Therefore the king of Israel gathered together of the prophets 400 men and said unto them, Shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear?" So let's ask ourselves, who are these men? Who are we talking about here? Therefore the king of Israel gathered together the prophets. Well, these weren't the prophets of God. These weren't true prophets of Judah. These were those who had been set up in this position by Ahab. And of course, when we go back, we see that back to Elijah's victory on Mount Carmel just a few chapters before, there were 450 prophets of Baal then, and there were 400 prophets of the grove left beside. And we can find this in 1 Kings 18. And so Jehoshaphat says, "Let's inquire of Yahweh." And Ahab says, "Oh, okay, let me call in 400 prophets of the grove and we'll see what they have to say." So Ahab proceeds to ask these prophets, "Shall we go or shall I forbear?" And of course these prophets say, "Oh yeah, go up. Go to God, or go up, for God will deliver it unto the king's hand." Now notice what they say here. They will go up, he says, "for God will deliver it." And look at the word, when we're talking about God, we know that this is the word or the title Elohim, right? Well, sometimes in these cases, we see how what we're referring to is the powerful one. So these prophets of Baal aren't referring to the God of Israel. They're referring to the powerful one. And so Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord besides?" Now when we're in verse 6, we see the Lord, this is Yahweh. "Is there not a prophet of the true God of Israel besides, that we might inquire of him?" So Ahab proceeds to ask these questions of these prophets. But Jehoshaphat replies, "And so how bad had things gotten in Israel? How bad? Where there was not a prophet of Yahweh to be had?" Now doesn't this seem like a most opportune time, brothers and sisters, for Jehoshaphat to stand up and back out and say, "You know, this really isn't the situation that I thought it was going to be. It's time for us to back out. You go up against Ben-Hadad, and I'm going to go back and fortify my own cities and people." Shouldn't he have realized then how incompatible they really were? The prophets of Baal? This obviously, like I said, it seems to be an enigma for us. How could he have done such a thing? But Jehoshaphat doesn't see what seems obvious to us, does he? And so Ahab replies by mentioning someone he really doesn't like. He says, well, there is yet one man that we may inquire of Yahweh. Now see, knows here he says, of the Lord, Yahweh. He acknowledges the difference then in this man and who he abides with, but he is definitely not happy with him. We see where Ahab flat out says, I hate him, for he never prophesies anything good unto me. And this is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. So he comes right out and tells him exactly what he thinks of him. I hate him. And so Micaiah enters the scene. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. And this is interesting for us to think about. Can we imagine Micaiah, meaning who is like Yah? And this is why he is opposed to Ahab continually. He comes out now as one of the stars in this account, one who sets things straight, who draws the line, differentiates between good and evil, between Baal and Yahweh. But look at Jehoshaphat's response. Does this give us a clue as to how he truly has gone down to Ahab? We can imagine how he would have replied a few years earlier, right? As he was strengthening and fortifying his people, as he sat upon the throne of David in Jerusalem, educating his people and encouraging them, he would have said, you hate this man because he doesn't condone your wicked behavior. You, evil Ahab. He would have given all that he had to him with regards to this evilness and the wicked ways that he knew he was doing. He would have given it to him, that is. However, instead now, he replies somewhat weakly, doesn't he? Somewhat sheepishly. He says, oh, let not the king say so. In other words, oh, come on, don't be that way. He's not really that bad, is he? And think about this. This is Micaiah. He knew exactly who he was. He was the son of the man who had spoken to his father. Jehoshaphat may be shocked here, but he says nothing, and he does nothing else about this. He sits there doing nothing. And so he tolerates Ahab's inappropriate words and actions concerning this righteous man. And so as they go and fetch Micaiah, I think I got ahead of myself there, but as they go and fetch him, we see the two kings sitting here, described in verse 9, in a void place. Sorry, I get a little worked up there. The king of Israel said, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, sat either of them on his throne, clothed in their robes, and they sat in a void place at the entering in of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. What a big splendor, this big show going on there as these two men sat with their thrones in the gate. Described here as a void place, clothed in their robes at the gate of Samaria. Well, do we know who built Samaria? We were talking about this a minute ago. Samaria, the city of Samaria, was built by Omri. And Omri was Ahab's father. And it's said that the statutes of Omri were kept there. And he, again, was an idolater. So what does the record say to us here? These two kings were sitting together. And sitting represents what? Sitting together represents fellowship, right? They were sitting in an empty place, a void place, void of the knowledge of the true worship of Yahweh. And so consequently, it's void of His help and of His compassion, isn't it? God had nothing to do with this union. They were clothed in these robes, and these as their outward expression of their authority and their rulership. They had their robes on. They were the kings. They were in authority. Did they realize that this was given to them by Yahweh? And yet now they abuse this authority by first forsaking the Lord God for His help, as for Jehoshaphat. And he was now in fellowship with this worker of iniquity. These robes were unfitting for what Yahweh intended for the king of His people. The word robes comes from this word, which means a covering. But it also, in this particular place, means treachery. Figuratively, to act covertly. Do I have that up there? Yeah. To act covertly. Or to deal deceitfully. And this is exactly, brothers and sisters, what was happening here. By seeking Yahweh after the fact, they were in effect dealing deceitfully, working undercover and treacherously before Yahweh, God of Israel. And so this is where they were, sitting in this void place, clothed in their robes, with these prophets dancing around them. So let's go back to Psalm 1:1 for a minute. We're all... That probably comes to mind as well, right? How can we think of sitting and standing without going to Psalm 1:1? Psalm 1:1, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. So look at how these are described here. Ungodly. Sinners, scornful, walketh, standeth, sitteth. And so Jehoshaphat then is sitting now with a scorner, isn't he? Absolutely. He's doing exactly what Psalm 1:1 tells him not to. And he's avoiding the goodness of what God affords him there. Another one is in James. And I don't have that one. So let's look at James 1, verse 14 and 15. We're familiar with this one as well, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And then, and when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. So again, here we have a progression as well, don't we? We have a progression here with the ideas, and the thoughts, the lust that conceives and brings forth sin. And sin is this outward acting upon those ideas and thoughts. And this is what brings forth death. And so we see Jehoshaphat sitting, clothed in fellowship with this scorner. So back in 2 Chronicles 18, verse 10 and 11, and Zedekiah, the son of Chechaniah, had made him horns of iron and said, Thus saith the Lord, with these thou shalt push Syria until they be consumed. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it unto the hand of the king. So, again, let's think of this environment here for a moment. Think of Elijah on Mount Carmel. Remember how this took place. Hundreds of false prophets were around him then. And how did they behave? Remember, we're told that they cut themselves with knives, and they chanted, and they danced about, leaping on and off the altar. 400 men were there, possibly doing the same thing then, in front of Ahab and Jehoshaphat, chanting and acting out, trying to give King Ahab confidence in what they were saying, which was a lie. They had no authority, they had no power to say these words, and yet they were telling him what he wanted to hear. It was really just a pagan ritual unfolding before Jehoshaphat as he sat silently and let it happen. And so the messenger goes forth to fetch Micaiah, and he brings him to the court, we see in verse 12. And look what he says here, this messenger. He tells him, behold, the words of the prophet declare good to the king with one assent. In other words, they're all together talking about how great and wonderful this is. Let thy words, therefore, I pray thee, be like one of theirs, and speak thou good unto him. So it's interesting. We can hear the warning in his voice, right? Everybody's good. Everybody's up here, and they're supporting the king, and you better do the same. You better come up with the same words that they are. Well, what does Micaiah say? What would we think? This didn't bother Micaiah. He responds boldly by saying, as Yahweh liveth, even what my God saith, that will I speak. So, what a confident and impressive thing for him to say in front of Ahab and Jehoshaphat. these two kings. We know that it's always hard to take a stand like he does here. We know that. We've been there. Maybe at our school or at our work. Maybe even at a Bible school or a gathering. When a discussion or a conversation starts to drift where you know it shouldn't, and you know that you should speak up, but brethren, it's very hard. Who are we going to be like? Jehoshaphat or Micaiah? It's at times like these that we need to think of this man standing up, one man standing up against 400 ranting and raving false prophets, opponents of Yahweh. And though it would be very tempting for him to change his message, to soften it somewhat, Micaiah stands up for Yahweh, and he does what is right, no matter the consequence. And we see that the consequences are often very severe. This is truly the example that Jehoshaphat needed right now. He needed a man who would make a stand, who would say and do what was right. Where was Jehoshaphat? He was completely absent on this issue. There he was, sitting, saying nothing. And look at this short phrase that Micaiah says. And think how Jehoshaphat must have felt when he said, "Even what my God saith." He wasn't associating Jehoshaphat with that in any way, was he? He says, "What my God saith, that will I speak." And he doesn't look at Jehoshaphat and say, "Our God," does he? But frankly, Jehoshaphat is not acting like Yahweh was his God at this point. Jehoshaphat probably knew that Micaiah was the much better man. And he should have been there standing beside Micaiah instead of sitting beside Ahab. So in verse 14, "And when he had come to the king said unto Micaiah, Shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And he said, Go ye up and prosper, and they shall be delivered unto your hand. And the king said unto him," you can just imagine him now, shaking his head, thinking, "See, I told you. How many times shall I adjure thee that thou shalt say nothing but the truth to me in the name of the Lord?" And notice here he mentions Yahweh. But in verse 16, then he says, "I did see all Israel scattered upon the mountains." This is Micaiah. He says, "I saw them scattered as upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, These have no master. Let them return, therefore, every man to his house in peace." And so the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "See, I told you. I did not tell thee that. Didn't I tell you that this he wouldn't prophesy good unto me, but evil?" And so we have here in this account this depiction of the two sides. We see Micaiah first says, "Go up, prosper. They shall be delivered into your hand. Do it." But the king knew that this wasn't the truth from Micaiah. He knew that. He said, "Aren't you supposed to tell me the truth from Yahweh?" And then he tells him exactly what was going to take place. If Ahab wasn't so determined to do evil, then Micaiah wouldn't be saying these evil things about him. But here in this next section in verse 18, it's interesting because it gives us a glimpse into how the court of heaven might work. Because now we have, in verse 18, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting upon his throne, and all the host of heaven standing on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who shall entice Ahab, king of Israel, that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one spake, saying after this manner, and another saying after that manner. And then there came out a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said unto him, Wherewith? And he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets. And the Lord said, Thou shalt entice him, and thou shalt also prevail. Go out and do even so." And so we see here in this account, in verse 18, this word "stood" or "standing by" in this depiction tells us that we're referring to an angel of the Lord and how they stood by. Sometimes, brothers and sisters, we think of angels as robots just acting according to exactly what God would say. But it's interesting here that this is kind of a depiction of possibly an angel or this group of angels talking about how they would accomplish God's will. In other words, passages like this show us that they work together in conjunction in order to fulfill His purpose. His purpose cannot and will not fail. It will come to pass as He allows these angels here to show their own initiative in using people of character or creativity to work out His plan. So in this particular case, God has already said, Ahab will die. He's going to die in Ramoth-Gilead. It's going to happen. It cannot fail. And He's commissioned certain angels to bring this to pass. But because this is what angels do, they work on God's behalf to fulfill this. And this is exactly what's happening here. But how exactly does it happen? And this is what we see described. Verses 20 and 21 depict this scene. With this discussion taking place, a certain angel comes forward and says, I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets. So he presents this suggestion about this lying spirit. And then he gives him his approval and says, the angel is sent out. Go and do this. So God's will is fulfilled no matter what. But it seems that this angel uses his own initiative. Now, what about this lying spirit? Ask ourselves, do angels lie? Well, of course not. Can angels sin? No, of course not. But God can and will use a particular character of a person, positive or negative, to achieve His goal. And so the angel says, I will make sure that the prophets of Baal tell their lies, the things that are necessary, so the whole plan goes forward and Ahab dies at Ramoth-Gilead. Isn't this a perfect way for Ahab to meet his demise? Ahab was a man who lived on lies. He lived on lies, and his wife ensured that, didn't she? And so the prophets were employed, these prophets of Baal were employed to tell lies. They didn't prophesy truth, they merely spoke what Ahab and Jezebel wanted them to speak. They told them that they needed to hear what they needed to hear. And this is what we see happening here. Yet through it all, as we know, and we have faith and confidence in, Yahweh is in control, just as He always is. And so the angels knew that Ahab had surrounded himself with people whose sole purpose was to deceive and lie. And so it was perfect to use a lying spirit to bring about this destruction, because Ahab was choosing it for himself already, wasn't he? He had already chosen that lifestyle and that frame of mind, and so now it was going to lead to his destruction. And so what can we gather from this, brethren? Well, we gather that God won't always stop us when we're intent on following our own path, will He? Or when we are intent on following or serving sin. In fact, God may let those very sins swallow us up, just as God let Ahab's spirit of lying swallow him up. In 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 and 10, Paul is warning of the Thessalonian ecclesia of a false religious system that was already at work among them. And it was going to thrive on lying and deceiving the people. Paul says that because of this system, it's not interested in believing the truth, God will allow that lying system to deceive them, much like Ahab and Jezebel and their lying system in Israel. What we're being told is that we can choose the path of our own destruction if we aren't careful and see and recognize the ways of the Lord. So to finish this section, we understand that the vision of Micaiah shows a stark contrast between Ahab's judgment hall, sitting here in this void place, very pompous with his robe on, or the heavenly court where Yahweh and his angels are working to direct our lives. They have their own leader, they both have their own messengers, and they both have their own spirit about them. But Micaiah is drawing everyone's attention to the enormous difference here between God's ways and Ahab's ways. So the court of Ahab in verse 9, as I have kind of depicted here, we have verse 9 versus the court of heaven in verse 18. And so here is where Jehoshaphat and Ahab sat, one each of them on their throne. But Micaiah says, I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne. See the difference? The court of Ahab with all 400 prophets prophesying before him. But in verse 18, we see all the host of heaven is on God's right hand and on his left. In the court of Ahab, we have the messenger, which was this word angel or Melech. And he went to call Micaiah. In the court of heaven, there came out a spirit or an angel to go forward with the purpose of Yahweh. And so we see Micaiah is smitten and thrown into prison and fed with the bread and water of affliction that's mentioned in verse 26. Put this fellow in the prison and feed him with bread and water of affliction, it says. And so Ahab says, until I return in peace. And he was confident in these words, in the words of the prophets that he had implored. He had ignored the words of Micaiah. He ignored the words of the prophet who had told him in 1 Kings 20, thy life for his life, and thy people for his people, speaking of Ben-Hadad, who Ahab was supposed to kill. But instead of killing him at that time, Ahab entered into a covenant with Ben-Hadad. And Ben-Hadad then began immediately to scheme how to kill Ahab. You see, all of this that's taking place now with the Syrians could have been avoided if Ahab would have done what he was commanded early on. He was told to kill him, and he didn't. Instead, he made a covenant with him. So, 1 Kings 20, verse 42 and 43. So Ahab was not going to return in peace based on the prophecy that we see there. And why didn't Ahab kill him? He was told to by the prophet. But our lesson, brethren, from this is that if we let the flesh off the hook, it will relentlessly pursue you until it kills you, just as Ahab did. He didn't put it down. He didn't overcome it like he was supposed to. Instead, he entered into a relationship with him, and it pursued him, and we see in this chapter, as represented by Ben-Hadad, it killed him. So back to Micaiah, we see that we never hear from him again. He's hauled out. And as he is being hauled out, he tells the people, he says, hearken, all ye people, or as the record in 1 Kings 22 says. You know, in our account in Chronicles, we have a corresponding account in Kings. In 1 Kings 22, he says, hearken, O people, every one of you. And who was sitting there listening? It was King Jehoshaphat, right? It's ironic that this same thing has already happened in Jehoshaphat's life. And I wonder if his conscience had bothered him at this point. Remember Jehoshaphat's father Asa at the end of his life. One of the last things that Asa did as he was turning his heart away from God was to take a prophet who was speaking words of truth and throw him in prison for speaking words of truth. Boy, the apple didn't fall far from the tree, did it? Jehoshaphat is sitting here in this splendor and all of his glory, and Micaiah takes the hard road, just like Hanani the seer in 2 Chronicles 16. Asa was angry with him as well, and so he put him in a prison house. Does Jehoshaphat feel compelled to stop this? All it would take is for him to stand up on behalf of this man of God and to be on the side of truth. But instead, he does nothing. And so to finish this section of the account, our lesson, that we see that the battle turns out exactly as Micaiah had prophesied. The Syrians are victorious. Ahab is dead. And Jehoshaphat barely makes it back alive. And the people are scattered like sheep without a shepherd. I guess we're a little over time, so we better stop right there and we'll pick up in just a minute. Boy, that went quicker than I thought. I'm sorry. We'll pause there for a little bit and come back.
Thank you, Rose.